You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the pandemic has spurred a new wave of entrepreneurship across the country, and that includes Wisconsin. We'll talk to an economic development expert about new businesses, self-employment, and what it all means for the state's economy. Now, tomorrow marks 20 years since the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. For those who were alive when they took place, they have certain personal memories about what happened, what led up to the attacks, and how the U.S. responded. But for today's middle school and high school students, the 9/11 attacks are history, something that requires education to explain and put into context. You can join our conversation about how we teach about 9/11 at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a middle school or high school student? How much do you know about how 9/11 has been taught in your kids' school? And if you are a student or teacher yourself, how are you talking about 9/11 and the 20th anniversary in your classroom? Maybe this week. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Our next two guests have run a study over the last two decades looking at how the attacks have been taught in schools. Jeremy Stoddard is professor of the Secondary Education Program at the UW-Madison School of Education. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Diana Hess is dean of the UW-Madison School of Education. Diana, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, too.
Diana, can you start by telling us about the motivation and the beginnings of this study that started not long after the event itself?
So on 9/11, I was teaching a class for students who were student teaching in area schools, and I was going to cancel the class because, as people who remember this remember, there was so much uncertainty about what was happening. And I started getting calls from the students saying, don't cancel class. We need help thinking about what we should do. You know, how should we talk about this with our students? And so we ended up having class that night and focused a lot on, you know, how to respond to traumatic events literally in the moment. And we noticed in the couple weeks afterwards that a lot of organizations were starting to develop curriculum materials on 9/11. So we just decided to study very methodically the curriculum materials that were published in the year after 9/11 to try to get a sense of what the similarities and differences were and how, you know, very shortly after this traumatic event, it was being presented to school children. And then later we expanded the study to include textbooks and state standards and eventually, you know, a very large survey of high school teachers that Jeremy was the principal investigator of.
And Jeremy, what did you find after that immediacy went away? What were some of the key themes you started to see emerging in how schools were teaching about 9/11?
Yeah, I think we've seen pretty consistent themes even since that first study in terms of what 9/11 sort of is in textbooks and in state standards and then in some of the videos and materials shown. And those consistent themes are that it's a, you know, it was an unprecedented and shocking attack, that the heroism of firefighters and first responders, and that the world sort of came together behind the U.S. to then combat the evils of terrorism. And those sort of main themes have been pretty consistent since essentially that initial curriculum was developed.
Diana, before we dig more into what's being taught and what could be taught, why is it important to have this conversation, to look at the way we're talking about 9/11, especially now that we have a lot of students who, of course, weren't born by 2001?
Well, I think 9/11 clearly was an incredibly significant event, not just for the United States, but for, you know, many nations around the world writ large. And if you look at, you know, the aftermath of 9/11, you know, that those things continue to infect us today. So I think that many teachers are interested in helping their students understand 9/11 because they believe their students are living in a world that was affected by 9/11. And it's important for students to understand, you know, quite literally what happened on that day and what the aftermath was, and also what some of the controversies were.
And Jeremy, the list you just gave of things that are taught, you point toward in a lot of your work a lack of context surrounding 9/11. And in reading some of your work, very literally, the way a school year works, when the 9/11 anniversary rolls around, it might be Civil War, Civil War, Civil War, 9/11, Reconstruction. I mean, it really, it's this sort of super out of context thing just based on the flow of a school year. How common is that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big challenges that the teachers reported to us in the survey that we did, that it because it falls at the beginning of the year and so many states are driven now by these standardized courses that really sort of lay out the course chronologically. So otherwise, they would only get to it at the end of the year and then maybe not have the time to really engage with it. So that's why teachers are still doing it on the anniversary, because they believe it was, you know, such a significant mm-hmm. event and they want students to know about it.
We are talking about how we teach 9/11 in our schools, middle schools and high schools, for example. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a younger student, what did you see, what did you learn in your classrooms about the September 11th, 2001 attacks? If you teach, what are some of the challenges of trying to teach about it? What do you think of the curriculum that you are able to have access to? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Diana, what are your thoughts on some ways, age-appropriate ways as kids get older, to talk about and set some of that context up for talking about September 11th?
Well, I think obviously it would differ depending on the age of mm-hmm. students, but it's very important for young people to learn about 9/11, quite literally to learn what happened. You know, one of the things that Jeremy and I have found is that even in textbooks that have whole sections on 9/11, sometimes they have a kind of shocking lack of detail. So we think it's important for students to understand what happened on that day, but equally as important to understand what happened in the aftermath, and especially a number of the things following 9/11 that were exceedingly controversial, like, for example, the war in Iraq.
And Jeremy, you offer on a UW website a lot of curriculum material for schools, districts, and teachers to use. What kind of, can you give us a sense of the range of material you have available?
Yeah, this really was driven by the survey too. We asked teachers sort of what would you want to be able to do a better job with this, right? Teachers recognize that to young people today, this is history. This isn't something that they experienced or that they have memory of. And so to make up for the lack of detail and some of the other resources that were developed at a time when the assumption was people had a living memory of it, we developed a set of resources to address some of the things that teachers wanted. And these include the sort of war in Afghanistan with the Soviet era and the role of the U.S. During that time with the Mujahideen, to the history of sort of the TSA and the rise of the TSA, to also including things post 9/11, including veterans' perspectives, and especially the perspectives of some of the Iraqi and Afghan interpreters and refugees that have now come to the U.S.
And I understand, Diana, that teachers surveyed in many cases, not surprisingly, have run into misinformation related to 9/11. What do schools and teachers need in their toolkits when their students come in to talk about this stuff they found on the internet?
Well, I really think it's increasingly important for us to teach young people how to assess the veracity of the information they're encountering. And we know that's incredibly difficult. I think one of the things we saw in the survey is that, you know, teachers are concerned about students' access to misinformation and conspiracy theories. And I think, Jeremy, you have more details on this, but I think we even encountered some teachers who themselves believed in conspiracy theories.
Yeah, yes, we had at least one teacher that we interviewed described sharing conspiracy theories as sort of an alternative understanding of especially how the buildings basically fell in the World Trade Center in New York.
Yeah, how do you recommend schools deal with that? Not just that misinformation coming in, maybe that the students saw and were curious about, but if it's coming from inside the building.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we heard from a lot of teachers, we didn't have this as an option. It came up in the other category, which was populated with both issues of misinformation in general, like heard the story secondhand from my uncle, and it just happened to be not really accurate, to really blatant sort of conspiracy theories that students were finding online and bringing into the classroom. And also a lot around sort of the myth of Muslims all being terrorists that was done around the time of the survey was in 2018. So it was also in the rhetoric around the Muslim travel ban. And so we had teachers who really explicitly said one of the strategies they use is sort of use 9/11 because it's at the beginning of the year to both teach about sort of media literacy and to use it as essentially the case study of what a conspiracy theory is. And that this was done in a way to inoculate the students from you know, sort of being able to recognize other conspiracy theories as they run across them.
We're talking to Jeremy Stoddard, professor of secondary education at UW-Madison in the School of Education, and Diana Hess, dean of the School of Education. We're looking at the results of a ongoing two-decade study they've worked on, looking at how teachers teach the history of 9/11 as we're getting ready to mark the 20th anniversary, and how schools could do it better. And they offer help with items for curricula for schools at various ages. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on how schools do, could, or should teach about the September 11th attacks? Are you a teacher who's had to grapple with these questions in the classroom yourself? What's your classroom experience been like? Do you feel like you have the tools available for you to talk about these issues with your students? If you recently graduated in the last, I don't know, 5-10 years or so, how were you taught about 9/11? What did you think? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk about how 9/11 is taught in schools with Jeremy Stoddard and Diana Hess from the UW-Madison School of Education. They've been looking at, studying, thinking about education about September 11th since the attacks themselves 20 years ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you think we should be talking about 9/11 in our schools? What did you witness yourself as a student, a parent, as a teacher? If you're a teacher, do you feel like you need more and or better curriculum available for you to help teach kids? Does it kind of stand out at the beginning of the school year as you start to, say, teach that American history class? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Jean is with us in Fox Point. Jean, hello.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear, Jean. Go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks for taking my call. It's a little bit of an outlier comment, and I just want to say commend your guest. I'm a UW-Madison School of Education grad from 100 years ago in 1990. But in any event, wanted to share, I was in New York City on 9/11, and one thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is how wonderful people were to each other in Manhattan while we were there when the tragedy was happening. And I just wish we could share more of that with our students. It was a time where people were just so kind to one another. I had to take the train back from New York City to Milwaukee, and people were just sharing things on the train. They were sharing their sweaters. I remember a guy passed around, you know, a bag of peanut M&Ms because we were all business travelers. So none of us were expecting to stay in New York for longer than a day or two, and all the flights were grounded. And so I feel like that gets missed in talking about 9/11. It really united our country, unlike some other tragedies that have gone on, including COVID. And I just wish that were talked about more.
Thanks for that call, Jean. Jeremy, you said that is one of the themes that comes out, the idea of people uniting. But what do you think of trying to use perspectives like Jean's first-person perspective there and making sure you've got a good representative variety of them when we talk about September 11th?
Yeah, we've in our collection especially, we've included a number of StoryCorps recordings, which bring in a whole number of perspectives, both in terms of the types of things that Jean was just talking about, as well as some of the perspectives, say, from Muslim Americans on or around the time of 9/11. There's also a number of short documentaries that were made that are used in classrooms that I think reflect that. One's called The Boat Lift, which is narrated by Tom Hanks and tells the story of how all of the different ferries and things helped to get people off the island of Manhattan on that day because other services like the subways were shut down. So there are a number of resources, I think, that really do reflect that. And I think one of the really powerful things that are available for students to teach about 9/11 are sort of some of the personal perspectives of people that were in New York or in D.C. at the time. And that can, I think, help students today, young people today, sort of understand how people experienced it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Gene, at 800-642-1234. in the midst of a lot of the curriculum material you have available online, there's a lot of primary sources, original documents, I think, and speeches. And one points toward looking at the experience of Muslims in the United States after 9/11. We have an example, one of them here, a clip from a longer speech by then President George W. Bush. This is, I think, just a week after the attacks. Here's a listen.
Muslims are doctors, lawyers, law professors, members of the military, entrepreneurs, shopkeepers, moms and dads, and they need to be treated with respect. In our anger and emotion, our fellow Americans must treat each other with respect.
Diana, can you talk about talking about the Muslim American experience in our 9/11 curriculum?
You know, it's interesting. I haven't listened to that excerpt from that speech for a long time, and it just takes me back to seeing it live and being so incredibly impressed by what President Bush said in that talk. And I think the message that he was trying to, you know, make, you know, very, very clearly is it is not appropriate to stereotype and to use this as an excuse to be disrespectful or to mistreat anybody. And I think, you know, he did a very, very good job of making that point. And, you know, kind of pulling together what Gene just said and what we just heard President Bush say, you know, I do think it's important to provide young people with examples of things that are laudatory. So it's important to provide young people with examples of what does it look like when the country comes together, like what Gene was describing or what Jeremy has described in so many documentary films. And also, you know, what does it look like when a leader makes a strong statement, you know, against stereotyping and the mistreatment of anybody? I think it matters to have those positive things put before students.
Let's go back to our callers now. Stephanie is with us in Janesville. Stephanie, hi.
Hi, actually, I'm calling from Seensville, picked up my fourth grader, and I said to him, did you guys talk about 9/11 today? And he said, no. And I was in Astoria, Queens, on 9/11. I watched the buildings fall from the roof of my building. And so, as you can imagine, we talk rather frankly about our experience in New York that day, and I've been frustrated a little bit that our district has not discussed 9/11 with our kids up until the middle school level. I think that 9/11 could be talked about in terms of heroism and courage and, like one of the previous callers said, what people did for each other that day. There was a lot of confusion, a lot of fear, a lot of people thought that the water might be contaminated. People thought that the ATMs were going to empty out. So everybody was rushing to get cash. All sorts of things were happening beyond the geopolitical that could be discussed in terms of heroism and courage, you know, to reach a younger student. But it's such a big event, and it has altered the course of our lives.
Stephanie, thanks for calling in from Thiensville. Sorry, I think we misheard you originally there. Jeremy, a fourth grader. So teaching kids at the elementary school level about 9/11, what do you think?
I think people have to use their judgment in terms of how you would talk about something like this. Obviously, you wouldn't want to show some of the video because it is so traumatic. But there are a number of sort of picture books written for younger kids that both talk about experiences from that day from the perspective of youth. There was also in the original curriculum, we had the experiences of kids in a school that were right near the World Trade Center that also sort of focused on their experiences that day. And then there are some, like I said, some of the videos, I think, do focus on aspects that I think would be appropriate for a fourth grader that still talk about the gravity of the event, but wouldn't show some of the more traumatic, I think, footage that you would even see on the live news feed at the time.
Thanks for that call. And that reminds me, Diana, I wanted to ask about that. I was talking to one of my kids, my kids are out of high school now, but they talked about, seeing the videos of people jumping out of the towers and things like that in their classroom education. How do we deal with issues of potentially traumatic imagery as we're teaching about this?
Yeah, I think it's really challenging. And especially, you know, on that day when, you know, a number of teachers had televisions on in their classroom and we were watching live what was happening. And, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. So I think a lot of, you know, students did see things that were really, really traumatic, which I think is one reason why some teachers are nervous about, you know, watching a live event like that. I was teaching high school social studies when the Challenger exploded. And I remember just being absolutely gobsmacked about what to do. My students started crying. It was really, really difficult. So I do think that there are special problems kind of in the moment. That being said, what Jeremy's talking about now retrospectively, I think, is making good decisions about what makes sense to put in front of students at different age groups. And I, you know, going back to what Stephanie was saying, I think it's absolutely the case that fourth graders are old enough to learn about 9/11. And my hunch is that is happening in many schools. And I think that it's, you know, sometimes we get overly cautious about protecting our students from things. You know, we certainly don't want to traumatize students, but we also do want students to understand, you know, what has happened and what is happening.
And briefly, Jeremy, you shared a tweet about concerns about stigmatizing Muslim American students when we're talking about 9/11 in schools. Could you share a quick thought on avoiding that?
Yeah, we had a number of the teachers that we surveyed and then did interviews with afterward talked about, and again, this was in the context of late 2018. So this was in the sort of national political rhetoric around the potential ban on people from Muslim, primarily Muslim countries. And their fears were twofold. One fear was they didn't want to introduce a conversation around, you know, things related to terrorism, 9/11, because they were afraid that this stereotype could come up in their class to protect their students that were Muslim. On the other hand, they were also a little afraid or anxious about students who may bring in some of that more sort of hateful stereotype, you know, Islamophobic sort of speech into their classroom. And so I think this is a real issue and sort of a growing issue again that wasn't there for quite a while. And I think especially today when we have, you know, new Afghan refugees coming into the U.S., that it would be a great time for teachers to engage their students in talking about the role that these people have played, you know, over the last 20 years.
And we'll jump in. Thanks to both of our guests, Jeremy Stoddard and Diana Hess from UW-Madison School of Education, looking at how we teach about 9/11. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, it's time for fall yard projects. Keep an eye out for invasive plants. We'll find out which ones you're most likely to encounter and how to get rid of them for good. Now, starting a new business is a lot of work, but a growing number of people in Wisconsin and across the country are doing just that during the pandemic. New business applications in the state hit their highest level since at least 2005 last July. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. And this year, those numbers have continued to be higher than pre-pandemic levels. We're talking now about what's behind a growing wave of entrepreneurship during the pandemic and how it could impact the state's economy. Tessa Conroy is with us. She's an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. Tessa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know it's going to be a while before we have full-on data for this last pandemic year, but what are some theories about why there's an increase in new businesses starting up during the pandemic?
Yeah, it really has been a surge in new business applications and this entrepreneurial activity. And I think there are several potential explanations. So those might include, for example, people who have turned to entrepreneurship or, you know, striking out on their own out of need or necessity. So perhaps they've been laid off or they aren't comfortable returning to their former position. It could be also just a changing perspective on work. It seems that the pandemic for a lot of people has caused a moment of pause and rethinking. Maybe I'd like to be doing something I'm more passionate about. I think there's also potential for changing demand, that consumer preferences have changed. the way we shop, the way we purchase things, the types of activities we spend our time doing. And with that has come new opportunities for businesses. So there are these push factors, potentially, as well as these pull factors. And I think it's important to keep in mind also that with this pandemic, the financial circumstances have been so different than, say, the Great Recession. So we haven't seen the markets decline the way they did in 2009. We had rounds of stimulus. So people are in a different financial position, including their home values as well, than they were in 2009.
There are a lot of different ways to measure the health of the economy. And I know one thing people look at is how much business startup activity there is. Why is that an important thing to watch? Why do we worry when it slows down?
Right. Entrepreneurship is a really important mechanism for economic recovery, and that's because new businesses are disproportionately responsible for new job creation. So when we look at job loss from an economic downturn and think about getting those jobs back, new businesses are a big part of that equation. So we want to be paying attention to, are new businesses starting? Are they hiring employees? Is that generating income for households?
When we think of a business startup, or when I hear the phrase, I'll say business startup, I think my mind pops to some fancy Silicon Valley type high tech thing with bustling offices and such like. You've done a lot of studies here in Wisconsin, and probably this is true elsewhere. A lot of those new businesses might be a person, one person. Can you talk about that that part of our business creation here?
Right. So these are called non-employers. These are businesses without paid employees. So they might be just the man or woman, him or herself, that's running the business. It might have unpaid family members, but generally these are very small. And these actually make up the majority of businesses in the country and in Wisconsin. About three quarters of businesses are actually these non-employer businesses. And when it comes to startup activity, we're actually seeing a lot of these types of businesses during the pandemic, these non-employers. And so again, a lot of people maybe just striking out on their own or running a home-based business. And I think it's important to keep in mind that sometimes these businesses don't get as much attention because they're, you know, they don't have paid employees and they're less likely perhaps to go on to hire and grow and be that engine of economic growth. But they're still creating a job at least for one person. And that's important. Also contributing potentially to quality of life in rural areas with the goods and services that they provide.
And so this could be setting up a shop as a consultant or a craftsperson. It's just me and I'm doing jobs for people around town or hair salon type activities. This could cover a wide variety of business activities, right?
Exactly. And during the pandemic, one of the areas that we saw the most growth in was non-store retail. So presumably these are people maybe selling things from home or they've created an online business, an online shop in retail. And it's just one person behind that storefront.
Talking to Tessa Conroy from UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, talking about new business creation before and during the pandemic. And let's talk about who is involved here. You've broken it down, at least as much as you can, given the data out there, Tessa, by race. Can you talk about how important these businesses, especially these smaller ones we were just talking about, to people of color, for example?
Right. So people of color are more likely to own non-employer businesses. So this seems to be a really important mechanism or pathway to entrepreneurship. I think that it's important, though, to also understand that that can make businesses owned by people of color more vulnerable during an economic downturn like the pandemic. So they don't have employees. They tend to also be smaller in terms of the sales they earn. And so it makes it more difficult to accumulate the cash reserves that are important to be able to flexibly manage a downturn. And I think that's part of why we saw some of the largest declines in self-employment among people of color early in the pandemic.
Did that bounce back as the shutdowns started to wind down?
Yes. And I think that's one of the hopeful stories of the pandemic is that we did see those self-employment numbers come back for people of color within a few months. It follows a similar trajectory to what we saw with new business applications. There was this initial decline when the pandemic first hit during those first few months, and then things seemed to accelerate in the second half of 2020. I think, though, we want to also be aware that we're just looking at the number of businesses. It's hard to say how those businesses were doing in terms of, you know, maybe these people returned to their business because they had to. There weren't a lot of other choices, and it's hard to know if they were really thriving again or if they just reopened but are still struggling through these remaining months of the pandemic.
What are some of the policies we know about that can help support entrepreneurship?
I think specifically when we're looking at businesses owned by people of color, we want to keep in mind any sort of language barriers, any sort of technical assistance, any sort of requirements that might disproportionately impact people of color with regard to language identification and the size of businesses. So, for example, if we have a, you know, a state or federal program that is geared towards employer businesses, it's far less likely that we have people of color with employer businesses. So we're just not going to be able to serve them as broadly as if we included the non-employers, for example.
Now, are there big barriers to entrepreneurship, healthcare costs that people might worry about, or, you know, am I going to be able to fund a retirement if I'm starting a business? Are there things like that that might need to be solved at a higher level than just my business?
So two factors that come to mind, definitely health insurance is one of them. We know that when a person who is considering entrepreneurship has, for example, a spouse or partner through whom they can access health insurance, that makes a big difference in how likely they are to actually go on to pursue that business. We also know that capital, access to financing, is a huge barrier. Undercapitalization is one of the main struggles of new businesses. So to the extent that we can support small business lending through banks, but also community development financial institutions, local rotating loan funds, these are all ways that we can support entrepreneurs of all types.
What are you watching for now? The pandemic still creating rough roads for the economy. What are you watching for in the months to come when it comes to business creation?
So what's so fascinating about the business application statistics is that these are applications. So these are very much a forward-looking indicator or an early signal of entrepreneurial activity. We don't know for sure how many of those businesses are actually going to convert into realized businesses with paid employees. So we've seen the surge of applications, but I'll be watching to see if those businesses actually turn into, again, those realized businesses with paid employees over the next several months to 2 years.
Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Tessa Conroy, assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. She was with us today to talk about how the pandemic is impacting entrepreneurship and what a rise in new business applications could mean for the state's economy. Coming up, we'll get some tips on how to deal with invasive plants in our yards, especially as we do fall cleanup projects. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Believe it or not, the first day of autumn is less than 2 weeks away. It's a good time to think about some of those fall yard projects. Maybe you want to seed your lawn, get rid of some weeds, clean out the dead plants in your garden, or brighten up the property with some fall flowers. Whatever it is, keep an eye out for invasive plants. This is inspired, this conversation, by a personal experience. I ran into a plant I was unfamiliar with last month in my yard. It ended up getting huge, turned out to be burdock, which you don't want in your lawn. Even with gloves and long sleeves, I ended up with hundreds of tiny thorns in my hands and arms with a lot of tweezer work to get them out, plus taping duct tape on my skin to try to pull them all out. If you've got a question or story about invasive plants in your yard, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Granberg is an invasive plant specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
What makes a plant invasive? How do we define that?
So invasive species, they include both animals, plants, and diseases. And especially when it relates to plants, these are plants that grow quickly in the landscape. They often green up first before the other plants. They have high reproductive rates, and they've got different modes of spreading through the landscape. Some of them spread by seed, some of them by vegetative growth. Some of them do both. And they can quickly move throughout the landscape. They can be transmitted by humans, animals, wind, water. And they're also very tolerant to a wide range of environmental conditions and habitats.
So for kind of an ignorant yard haver like me, if I run into a plant, I'm like, is this invasive or not? Where do you point people toward for resources to figure out if this is one of the bad guys?
So we have a website. It's at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. You can type into your favorite search engine, Wisconsin DNR and invasive species, and that will take you to our main page. And there we've got a variety of different kinds of information for you to look at, how to report them, how to prevent them, how to control them. And we also have some invasive species ID guides that are available.
What are some of the usual suspects we're going to run into in, you know, a lawn yard type of environment?
So on our page, we have lots of species that are regulated for some purposes because they've got impacts to the economy, environment, and human health. But not all of them are going to be found in your yards. So common ones that you may find maybe in south central Wisconsin, wild parsnip is one of them. You can have pokeweeds. Some of the ones that you just had encounter with, so are thistles, teasels, nettles, and burdocks, the different pokey ones. And we also have species like our nightshades, which have like tiny little berries, which can be poisonous if ingested.
Let's talk about what to do with these things. Now, ideally, we get them earlier, and we'll talk about that. But with this burdock, I didn't want a little Shop of Horrors scenario where I put it in my compost or somewhere where it's going to plant itself and grow lots more of it. What do you recommend for people for disposing of these big invasive plants?
Our recommendation for disposal is when you take the plant and you dig it out, is to have the roots dry out as best you can, and then place that into a clear plastic bag, and you can put a sign on it that says, invasive plants, do not compost, add to landfill.
Right, and usually your local landfill doesn't want your plant material. Invasives, that's an exception?
Well, when it comes to like your lawn waste, some places will take that and they'll compost it. Mm-hmm. The problem with composting invasive plants is that the temperatures aren't high enough to kill them, especially if they have fruits and seeds. If it's added to the landfill and then buried, then that will help solve that problem.
We're talking about invasive plants in Wisconsin, how to spot and deal with them, especially maybe as you're doing your fall yard cleanup, maybe even your fall hikes. You can join in if you have a question at 800-642-1234 or an experience to share. Jason Granberg is with us with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jason, fall is the time I encountered my invasive plant. I'm guessing I would have been a lot better off if I'd gone looking for them and identifying them in the spring. What advice do you have for people looking ahead to the springtime in their yards?
So even right now, if you might have invasive plants that are in your yard, if you find any of them that are kind of like a woody perennial, they're likely going to return into the next year. Do the best you can to remove them and then dispose of them, as I had said. But you will want to take a look for them after the first thaw, and that will be the ideal time to dig them out of the ground. You may also have to be vigilant in your yard throughout the year because different species will appear throughout different times of the year, and they'll be identifiable at different times too.
Now, as I understand it, part of why we worry about these invasive species, they're not just weeds that we don't like being there. Some of them cause harm, like this burdock, bad for a lot of wildlife species. These are things that can cause damage to people and other species, right?
Absolutely. So with some of our invasives, when they enter into the landscape, they cause issues with not only the biodiversity in the landscape, but they also impact the ecosystem services that the environment provides. So here's one example. So Japanese hops is one of them. So once it comes into landscape, it will colonize along the stream corridors, the riparian landscape. And then what it will do is it will die back earlier in the season and it will leave these open bare stream corridors. If there's any major rain events or you could have these different minor flooding in the floodplain, that will then move any of that sediment that's along that stream corridor and it will flush it downstream, leading to bank destabilization. Hmm. Other cases where you might have invasives is that when they enter into the landscape, they'll green up earlier than anything else. And if you have some shrubby species, they can prevent the native shrubs from establishing. Not only that, but it will change the structure of where our different bird species are going to colonize and where they're going to put their nests. Some of them will have a lower spot in the forest canopy, and they'll establish their nests there. Then any predators, it makes it easier for them to then feed on the nest itself.
Let's bring a caller into the conversation. Kim is with us in Madison. Kim, hello.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring
Thanks
up,
for
Kim?
Calling. Hey, So my question is, we have lots of thorns growing or thistles growing in our yard. For years, we've been trying to avoid applying chemicals. So we've been hand pulling, but it seems like a never-ending defeated battle. So is there any solution that we can get rid of thistles without using chemicals?
I also encounter thistles on my own property, and I try to avoid using herbicides myself. And so what I've done is, not only do I cut the material above and to prevent the prickling, I've had to go through these thick cowhide gloves before.
Oh, yeah.
So I get a pair of like kitchen tongs in one hand, and I grab the plant, and I got my clippers in the other hand, and then I'll snip those off, and then I'll put them in the bag for disposal, like I said. And then you still have that basal part, that basal rosette. Part of that is going to be trying to find where those rosettes are first establishing and then killing them while they're very tiny. Once they're bigger, they can then have enough resources and then sprout again. So trying to kill them manually requires diligence and continued removal.
Kim, thanks for the call. Good luck. Tom joins us now in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
I have for what probably some kind of a strange question, but I know someone who years ago planted purple loosestrife in their garden and finally found out not a good thing to do when it took over their pond. And recently I saw someone, it appears they planted Egyptian Phragmites in their garden. Is that kind of thing legal?
Tom, thanks for calling. Not a strange question at all, Jason. A lot of these started as things people were planting, right?
Right. So that's how we have many of our invasives. As they first enter into the U.S., some of them were planted intentionally. So first off, to deal with your purple loosestrife, we have a purple loosestrife biocontrol program where we work with our local operators, their cooperative invasive species management areas, and other partners, and they develop these colonies of these purple loosestrife eating beetles. Then they can then be released into the landscape, and they can feed on them. For the Phragmites issue, that's a major issue that's happening in the eastern part of Wisconsin. And there's been tens of thousands of dollars that have been spent towards that. When it comes to the actual purchase of invasive plants, we have an invasive species rule in Wisconsin called NR40. And any species that's listed on that, which also includes the purple loosestrife and the Phragmites, you cannot transport, transfer, or if it's prohibited, possess the species. So if someone were to purchase it and then install it in the property, that would be illegal per NR40.
Tom, thanks for that call. Jason, we focus mostly on our yards, but I know, of course, in our wild areas, we're very worried about invasive species. How can we make sure we don't help them spread when we're out, say, hiking or hunting or fishing or you name it?
There's this great phrase. It's called play clean go. So go out, enjoy the natural areas, your parks, your state natural areas, your woodlands. Go out and enjoy these places. Or if you work in them, if you work in construction, or if you're out there doing your gardening itself, once you're done, clean any of the equipment that you've been bringing with you. So it could be some of your gardening materials, your boots and clothes. You can have seeds and dirt get in the treads of that. If you're out there enjoying the native places with your pets, with your dogs, make sure that they don't have any mud that's in their paws or on their fur. You can brush that off. And then with those things in place, you'll help prevent the spread of the invasive species between your yard and natural places and back.
And Jason, just in our last minute, that burdock, I mean, it looked like my gloves and arms were covered in tribbles. And it like got in under my gloves and under my sleeves. Like, any advice on dealing with this stuff?
I would say it's great to have those gloves, and if there's anything that's prickly and it's small for you to handle, you can always use a pair of tongs. That's what I do when I'm handling the thistles in my own yard. You can also use some larger gardening equipment if you would, if it helps you handle it with one part so that you're not poking it through your clothing.
Excellent. Tongs next year. And Jason, just briefly as we wrap up, any new invasive plants in the state you're worried about right now?
So we have a new detection. It is Japanese stiltgrass that is on one of our forested areas that's in western Wisconsin. We've had work that's being done to find it and control it. There is European frog bit, and that's found in Marinette and Oconto counties. That is a wetland invader. And we're always looking for new prohibited invasive species. So these are plants and animals that are found on our invasive species list on our website. Some of them are in Wisconsin. Some of them are recently establishing. And if anybody has information about a new invasive plant, or if they come across a plant or animal that they don't recognize, it's the first time they've seen it, they can send an email report to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov. We can then work with our local specialists to do additional reconnaissance, confirm the plant, and then also seek funding to begin control.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Jason Granberg is an invasive plant specialist at the Wisconsin DNR. We talked to him about managing invasive plants in our yards and elsewhere. Again, that email to report suspicious plants or other invasives, you can send a photo to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show. Monday at 8, Kate Archer-Kett and her guests look at the latest research on nutrition and what it means for our health. That's Monday at 8 on the morning show. Up next, it's news. Then, after 20 years, scientists completed the first full sequence of the human genome. We take a look at what that means for the future of science and medicine. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.